This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why has Lebanon allowed Hezbollah to have its own militia? Here to talk about this and other questions relating to Hezbollah and Lebanon is Julia Shaker. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's an associate in Carnegie's Democracy and Rule of Law Project and deputy editor of the Arab Reform Bulletin. Earlier this year, she wrote a paper titled Lebanon, Finding a Path from Deadlock to Democracy. She's Lebanese and has lived in the U.S. for about 6 years. Julia Shaker, welcome to Fresh Air. What are you hearing from friends and family in Lebanon, and where are they in Lebanon?
Well, I'm hearing different views depending on where they are in Lebanon. So far, the bombing has been targeted in the sense that it has not yet hit downtown Beirut or, I guess, the central areas of Beirut. This changed yesterday when they started hitting some Christian parts, but primarily they have targeted the southern suburbs of Beirut and also, of course, southern Lebanon. And so from family and friends who were in southern Beirut for vacation, they have, of course, left and are now taking refuge in the northern Lebanon. Others have been evacuated, those with foreign nationalities, primarily Europeans. I believe Americans are still waiting to hear from the embassy, but they should be evacuated in the next couple of days. So it's a mixed picture depending on where you are in Lebanon. But in general, the consensus is that this is very shocking, that nobody was expecting it, and that there is a widespread sense of panic, everybody trying to get out because they don't know if this will be done in 2 weeks or if this might escalate and even become a regional conflict.
And your family is all safe right now?
Yes, fortunately.
What's your impression of how the bombing is affecting opinion within Lebanon of Hezbollah and of Israel?
Well, again, I think it depends on who you speak to in Lebanon. Lebanon is a very divided society, particularly in the past couple of years, because Lebanon is currently going through a transitional process, which was started with the death of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in 2005. He was assassinated in February 14 of 2005. And that divided Lebanon into two camps. And this is, of course, a generalization. But in general, politicians and also their constituents were divided into two camps, an anti-Syria coalition and a pro-Syria coalition. And basically because those who were in the anti-Syria coalition believed that Syrians were behind the assassination of the prime minister. And the debate that ensued from that and the international pressure on Syria eventually resulted in a Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon. And so it depends who you speak to from those camps inside Lebanon right now. What I hear is the Shiite constituents of Hezbollah are, of course, not losing their support for Hezbollah. In fact, this is consolidating Hezbollah's position as a defender of Lebanon against Israeli aggression. It is proving Hezbollah's mantra that Israel will always be hostile toward Lebanon and that Israel will always have reason to attack Lebanon. And therefore, it is enforcing this rationale for Hezbollah bearing arms and basically defending the country against Israeli aggression. That is on one side. On the other side, those who are not supporters of Hezbollah and those who have been trying to launch a debate about Hezbollah disarming and who have been pushing for Hezbollah to disarm on the grounds that as a political party, Hezbollah should not be allowed to have arms, just like any of the other political parties do not bear arms, that basically force should be a monopoly of the Lebanese state, not of one particular party. And so from their point of view, they are very enraged at Hezbollah's actions. They believe that Hezbollah should have not had the right to decide whether Lebanon should go to war or be at peace with Israel. And so, again, it's the response to these actions are mixed.
Are you concerned about the war spreading? Do you think that that is likely?
In terms of a regional conflict, I believe that if Hezbollah were to strike Tel Aviv, or if Israel believes that you know, let's say in 2 weeks they are not, they have not been able to stop Hezbollah from continuing to fire rockets. I believe then, I mean, this is complete speculation, but analysts believe that they might try to pressure Syria to put more pressure on Hezbollah. And in that sense, yes, we might see the spread of this conflict. But so far, for the next couple of weeks, I see it being limited to Lebanon. And one of the dangers is that this conflict might spread within Lebanon. This is something the Lebanese are very worried about. And this has to do with the rationale behind this military campaign to rid Hezbollah of its arms. I believe that the part of the assumption behind this military campaign is that if you can weaken Hezbollah to the point where you would deploy an international force in the southern border, but also you would expect the other Lebanese parties to be able to disarm Hezbollah. And I think this is a very dangerous assumption because of the nature of Lebanon and because disarming Hezbollah without Hezbollah's consent would be very dangerous, and it would be only be done in a violent way inside Lebanon. So there is fear among the Lebanese that this could create a civil conflict like the one, you know, we had 15 years ago.
And this would be coming at a time when Lebanon was becoming much more democratic.
Yes, this is coming at a transitional time for Lebanon, when Lebanon is really trying to revamp its economy, where some issues that have been taboo for the past 30 years are actually being put on the table, like the question of the electoral law, like the question of security reform, what to do about Hezbollah's arms. And so Lebanon was really at a key moment in its history, but at the same time, it's in a very fragile moment in its history because of how divisive these issues are. And so there's great potential, but there's also great danger as to what can happen in Lebanon.
Israel is famous for some of its surgical strikes, like in Entebbe. But Israeli leaders have said you can't do surgical strikes on Hezbollah because the leadership of Hezbollah and the weapons are integrated into the neighborhoods of South Lebanon. You know, that even the rockets are integrated into the neighborhoods. Does that strike you as an accurate picture?
I'm not an expert on the military capabilities of Hezbollah or where they keep them inside Lebanon, but I do know that, yes, their headquarters and where these leaders live, including Nasrallah, they live in very populous neighborhoods, primarily in the southern suburbs of Lebanon, this area called Dahye. And so that's where they live. And yes, these are very populated areas. They live in buildings with families and businesses. And so, yes, in that sense, any attempt to target at least, you know, the houses where these leaders live would be targeting civilians who live in those areas.
Do most of the civilians who live in those areas consider themselves followers of or advocates of Hezbollah?
Hezbollah's constituency is Shiite. They represent the majority of the Shiite community, which in itself is also the biggest group in Lebanon. So they do represent a large part of the Shiite group. And many poor Shiites live in the southern suburb. Shiites who left southern Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War and also during the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon. And so they left as refugees and came to Beirut and settled in these suburbs because they were more affordable. And so primarily that's where Hezbollah's constituency comes from. It's those Shias, Lebanese living in those areas. But there are also many other Shias living in the southern suburbs who do not support Hezbollah and who are either for the other Shia party, Amal. It's basically Hezbollah came out of Amal. It used to be Amal and then broke off. And Amal is also a Shia party, but it is not Islamist. It is a secular brand of Shia politics in Lebanon. And so some are supporters of that, and some are independent Shias who do not support either Hezbollah nor Amal, but because of the nature of the Lebanese state, have no representation of their own or have no politicians to represent them. So I would not say that everybody in those areas being targeted is a Hezbollah supporter.
Why has Hezbollah been allowed to have its own militia?
Well, I mean, you have to look at the history of how Hezbollah was formed. Hezbollah was formed after the Israeli occupation, the siege in Beirut in 1982. That's when they broke off from the Amal party. And they were armed, and their primary target was the Israeli soldiers who were in Beirut and also in southern Lebanon. And so initially, they were created as an underground group became, in the eyes of many Lebanese, a resistance movement against Israeli aggression. Because the Lebanese army was so weak, and because it was divided during the war, but then after the war, when the war ended, because the Lebanese army was too weak to be able to actually defend Lebanon, Hezbollah was allowed to keep its arms as a resistance army, or that's what it was called inside Lebanon. And the Taif Agreement, which is the agreement that ended the Lebanese civil war, and it was signed in Saudi Arabia in 1990, clearly specifies that all militias inside Lebanon would be disarmed. But the politicians signing the agreement, it was an unwritten rule that Hezbollah would not disarm, because Hezbollah was not necessarily a militia, but rather a form of resistance for Lebanon against Israel. So this is the background. This, of course, changed in 2000 when Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon. Many politicians inside Lebanon started calling for Hezbollah's disarmament on the grounds that there was no longer an occupation. And this weakened Hezbollah's role, because Hezbollah has always been able to play both roles very well simultaneously. One, the role of a Lebanese political party, very active inside Lebanon with various parliamentarians. Currently, I believe they have 14, with providing many services for the Shiite community. But at the same time, also the role of this national resistance movement, providing defense for the Lebanese against Israel. So in 2000, it saw this role being undermined. But the Lebanese, I mean, it was not a serious debate, because the Lebanese government and other Lebanese parties are not strong enough to be able to disarm Hezbollah.
So besides firing Katyusha rockets across the border into Israel, what function does Hezbollah play, the Hezbollah militia play in southern Lebanon? What does it
do
there?
Well, primarily, Hezbollah provides all the services for the residents of southern Lebanon. They run schools, they run hospitals, they run orphanages, charity groups. And so, in fact, they are they for all intents and purposes, run or govern southern Lebanon. Some villages, of course, other villages are governed by Amal, which is the other Shia group. And this has been the case in 2000, when Israel withdrew. Amal and Hezbollah sort of divided up the villages amongst themselves. And so that is the role of Hezbollah in some of these villages. It's, it basically governs them.
What about the militia? The militia isn't the political part. What is that?
Oh, the militia itself, the militia itself just patrols the border with Israel. But, you know, within Lebanon, they do not, I mean, Hezbollah has not used its arms in recent history against the Lebanese. And as far as I know, the militia does not have a military role inside Lebanon. Its role is that of patrolling the border and, as you said, launching rockets across to Israel.
And does it have the silent or spoken approval of the Lebanese government and the Lebanese military to fire those rockets into Israel? Or, you know, did it before this conflict started?
Well, the Lebanese government's position has been that Israel continues to violate its agreements by flying over Lebanese airspace, and also by, in the past, firing into Lebanon. So the unspoken agreement is that you need a deterrent force in the south, that Hezbollah would play the part of deterring Israel entering Lebanon or Israel attacking Lebanon. So that used to be the case. Recently, there has been a series of national dialogue sessions, which were between all the major parties in Lebanon, and these were launched about 6 months ago. And the goal behind these sessions was to discuss these issues. The top issue on the agenda was Hezbollah's arms, and the Lebanese government has many elements in the Lebanese government, primarily the prime minister, have been pushing for Hezbollah to disarm, particularly in the past 2 years. But this is still an issue that was on the table. It was being discussed. It was a very difficult issue to solve. And I think the Lebanese government, at the end of the day, I mean, realize that they cannot, that this issue is not just a Lebanese internal issue, that even if there was consensus among most parties in Lebanon that Hezbollah should disarm, that this could not occur because Hezbollah continues to play its role as a regional, defender of Arab rights against Israel, or that is the role they are seeking to play. And so the Lebanese government realizes that ultimately Hezbollah's disarmament will only occur within this larger regional framework, within a larger peace agreement perhaps between Israel and Syria and Israel and Lebanon, so that it is, the Lebanese government realizes it is powerless at this point to push for this.
But why is it powerless? I mean, it's the government, and Hezbollah's militia is one group's militia.
Right. Well, you have to look at the nature of the Lebanese state. Lebanon, while it appears to be a functional democracy in the sense that it has more freedoms or personal liberties than many Arab countries and has always been seen as this beacon of freedom in the Middle East, unlike other Arab states, Lebanon has no powerful national government. In fact, its biggest challenge, or its biggest curse, I guess, is that it lacks a central authority. The manner in which political power is distributed in Lebanon, it is distributed among various sects, which are de facto serve as mini-states for their constituents. So citizens are represented through these sects that are themselves represented in government. And so there is no consensus or common agenda. And therefore, no majority group in Lebanon has the ability to impose its will on the rest. Because, for example, when the leaders of the major communities can agree on specific issues, then they can push forward these issues. But when they cannot get things accomplished, and when they cannot agree, as for example, on the disarmament issue, then the entire system is paralyzed because the state just lacks the central authority and the, you know, institutionalized decision-making ability to be able to push for these changes. It is a very segmented political landscape. And I mean, this has been Lebanon's curse for decades, and it has, you know, haunted it since independence, and it is one of the main reasons for the civil war.
Is Hezbollah in any way a surrogate of the Lebanese military? When it was firing missiles, you know, rockets across the border into Israel, that's something that the Lebanese military couldn't do, but Hezbollah could do it. So did it have the kind of silent approval of the military or the government?
Well, the Lebanese military couldn't fire rockets against Israel because of its military capabilities, but also firing rockets would be a declaration of war between two sovereign states. What has happened in the past is, yes, Hezbollah has been able to fire these rockets without Lebanon paying for it, because Hezbollah does not represent the Lebanese state. Hezbollah is a militant group and a political party inside Lebanon, but it makes its own decisions, and it is not reflective of a decision by the larger Lebanese state to go to war with Israel. And so I wouldn't say it was approval. I would just say, as I've said before, that the Lebanese army and the Lebanese government could do nothing about it. Whether they approved or did not approve, Hezbollah would go ahead and fire these rockets. In the past, when Israel was in southern Lebanon, the Lebanese state believed that its territory was occupied, and in at that time there was overt support for Hezbollah's fight because they were defending national sovereignty and also trying to retrieve territory that was Lebanese. But after 2000, this changed, and because there was no longer Israeli presence inside Lebanon, there was less of a reason for Hezbollah to have arms and to be firing against Israel. But whether this is a very important point, is that whether the Lebanese government would like or would not like is really irrelevant as to Hezbollah's rationale for acting in southern Lebanon.
The Lebanese prime minister has made impassioned pleas to Israel and to the world to, you know, get Israel to stop the bombing. But the Lebanese government has not said that they consider this an act of war against Lebanon. In other words, the Lebanese government and the Lebanese military are not thinking of themselves as being at war with Israel. And I guess I'm wondering why they're not interpreting it as an act of war against their country. Is it? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think they are interpreting it as an act of war, as an act of aggression. But I think the prime minister is trying to create a ceasefire. I think he's trying to stop this from escalating. I think he also knows that it would be self-defeating for Lebanon to go to war as a state against Israel, because of the severely mismatched military capabilities. And so I think it is not in Lebanon's interest and in the prime minister's interest to launch a war against Israel. So what he is trying to do is to focus on the fact that this was not the Lebanese government taking or pursuing an act of aggression against Israel, that this was an act on the part of Hezbollah, an independent act on the part of Hezbollah, hoping that the international community will act and will at least call for an immediate ceasefire, because Lebanon's economy is being destroyed, civilians are being killed. And so I think the prime minister is trying to basically create damage control at this point and is pleading, like you said, the international community to act. So the last thing he would want to do is to officially declare war and have this crisis escalate.
The United States is waiting to send Condoleezza Rice to the Middle East. What do you think the international community could be doing to stop the fighting?
Well, I think right now there is a need for the international community to call for an immediate ceasefire. I don't think any diplomatic intervention or any negotiations can occur under the current circumstances with bombing going on both sides. And with I think the death count in Lebanon has passed the 250 up, and they're primarily civilians. And so I think the first thing that needs to be done is an immediate ceasefire. Now, beyond that, I think it is very important that I think this is a wake-up call for the United States and for European countries to realize that they need to be directly engaging in the Arab-Israeli conflict. That in the past 6 years, particularly under this U.S. administration, the U.S. has focused its strategic goals on eliminating the troublemakers in the region. And those troublemakers were Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Iran, and of course Hezbollah and Hamas. And so the idea was that by going after these instigators, you could change the strategic environment and make these conflicts or these problems easier to deal with. I think this particular crisis shows that approach is flawed, and that there is a severe need for the United States primarily to address directly these conflicts and to re-engage in the peace process. And what we are seeing is that the United States lacks the diplomatic tools to be able to control this crisis right now, because they cannot directly speak to Iran, they cannot directly speak to Syria, and they cannot directly speak to Hezbollah. And so the most that can be done is speak to one of the parties in the conflict, which is Israel, And so I think this crisis is showing that there is a severe lack of diplomatic tools, as well as that there is a need to reimagine or redefine how the U.S. has been approaching the region and how the European countries have been approaching the region.
One theory I've heard is that, you know, Iran gave its green light for Hezbollah to attack Israel because Iran wants to be dealt with. Iran wants the United States to deal with it, to talk with it, to negotiate with it. And this is a way of forcing the United States to deal directly with Iran. Do you buy that theory?
Well, yes, I think most of these theories are just speculation, but I do believe that this crisis could help Iran portray itself, which is what it's been trying to do, as a powerful regional player, as a powerful player in the larger Middle East, and in a sense to show that in a crisis like this, they can both escalate it and they can also limit it and even end it. I think this is an opportunity for Iran to prove to the U.S. and to other Arab countries that it is a powerful regional player and that it wants to be taken seriously in discussions about the region, and that that isolating it and refusing to dialogue with it is counterproductive. It wants to prove that in a crisis like this, it could both either escalate the conflict and it can also limit the conflict. And so I think this would be an opportunity for Iran to try to prove to the U.S. that it needs to be taken seriously in this crisis, and also at a larger sense in the region.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Julia Shaker. She's an expert on political reform in the Arab world. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she's an associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Project, and she's deputy editor of the Carnegie's Arab Reform Bulletin. Hezbollah was formed in 1982 after Israel drove the PLO out of Lebanon, and Hezbollah was formed as an opposition group to Israel. Like Hamas, it calls for the elimination of Israel. I guess one thing I've been wondering is if Israel succeeds in its agenda of eliminating Hezbollah. Hezbollah is—it's not a government, it's not a country. It's an independent group. How popular do you think its philosophy is, its agenda is, and if Hezbollah per se were wiped out by this current war, do you think that there would likely be another group that would come along and replace it?
Well, I think that the assumption is flawed, in the assumption that Hezbollah can be wiped out in this conflict. And I think this is a key point for understanding the crisis and for understanding Hezbollah's role. There is an assumption that the Hezbollah could be severely weakened and even destroyed through a military campaign, as we are currently seeing. And this idea is based on three assumptions. One, that Hezbollah can be defeated by military force. Two, that the blame for Hezbollah's actions lies in Damascus and Tehran. And three, that the Lebanese government could have the power to disarm Hezbollah. And I think all these scenarios ignore the reality of Hezbollah's, the nature of Hezbollah's role in Lebanon. Hezbollah is deeply, deeply rooted in Lebanese society. Unlike the PLO, which in 1982 was eventually driven out of Lebanon and taken on ships to Tunisia, Hezbollah is composed of Lebanese members, both its political arm and its military arm. And so, in a sense, Hezbollah's members are not going anywhere. They are part of the Lebanese society. And so I think if to handle the challenge that Hezbollah poses, you need a longer term vision and a longer term strategy over what you are envisioning Hezbollah's role to be inside Lebanon. A military campaign, as we are seeing right now, to try to wipe out Hezbollah is also causing great damage to the Lebanese infrastructure and to the Lebanese state as a whole. And the only hopes we have for Hezbollah to eventually, for its role in Lebanon to be undermined, is if you have the creation of a strong Lebanese state, a Lebanese state that can provide services for citizens, and a Lebanese state that can transcend this current transitional period to be able to assert its influence over Hezbollah. But a military campaign will, at the same time, while you are trying to weaken Hezbollah, you're also weakening the Lebanese government, which in the long run is your only hope for reigning in Hezbollah.
Hezbollah's goals include creating an Islamic state and eliminating Israel. How popular are those two parts of their agenda within Lebanon? I mean, Lebanon has a pretty large Christian population. I can't imagine that most Christians in Lebanon want to see an Islamic state.
Right. Well, Hezbollah stopped speaking about this goal of an Islamic state in the 90s, I believe. I mean, when they were first created, that was their goal. But I think Hezbollah realizes that Lebanese society, as you mentioned, is very diverse. There's a large Christian population. There's also large Sunni and Druze communities. And so it realizes that this goal in Lebanon is unattainable. And so in the past decade or so, I have not heard any Hezbollah statements about them wanting to impose Islamic rule in Lebanon. Rather, they have focused on their role of becoming a resistance movement or of the role of fighting Israel. But I think Hezbollah's leadership understands that given the diversity in Lebanon, that its goal is unattainable.
And what about the Hezbollah goal of, you know, eliminating Israel? Is that widely shared?
Well, I mean, again, it depends on to who you talk to in Lebanon. I believe that most Lebanese understand that there is no way to eliminate Israel and that Israel is there to stay and that Israel, that they share a border with Israel. And I think many Lebanese, particularly in the past, I would say, 10 years, after the civil war, there is a feeling inside Lebanon that people are sick and tired of conflict, that they are tired of war, and that they would like to rebuild the economy, to rebuild the state. And there was a sense of optimism that was created. At the same time, there is a feeling among many Lebanese in southern Lebanon that Israel continues to pose a grave challenge. The historical memory, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Israel was occupying Lebanon, and it wasn't that long ago that Israel had a siege in on Beirut. And so there is the sense that there is a lack of trust that Israel will not reoccupy Lebanon or that will not try to undermine Lebanon. And so I think it's a mixed bag, and I think the only way you can address these is through a comprehensive peace process that would address both the Lebanon's issues with Israel and also Syria's issues with Israel. And I'm referring to here to the disputed territory of the Golan Heights, which is Syrian territory that has been occupied by Israel since 1967. And so I think there are large issues that need to be addressed.
You're an expert in democracy in the Arab world. The Bush administration has tried an experiment in democracy by invading Iraq and forcibly creating regime change and trying to create democracy. What impact do you think that experiment is having on the Arab world? The ambition was to create democracy in Iraq and to have the ripple effect spread through the Arab world and into the Middle East.
Well, I think Iraq has, far from being a model for democratization in other Arab countries, it has actually it has become the poster child of what cannot happen or what should not be allowed to happen in the rest of the region. I think many people look to Iraq and fear that this is what may happen in their own countries if there is regime change. And in fact, the Arab regimes have pounded on this and been very happy to use Iraq as a scenario of, look what would happen if we were deposed. This is what you would get. You would get an Iraq. And so across the region, there is fear. There is disgust at what is happening in Iraq, at the civil violence there. And it is also showed that democratization to the region cannot be brought about by military intervention because of the nature of these societies, because they're so divided along ethnic, sectarian lines, and because there is no history of there's no recent history of democratic culture or democratic practice, and most of the opposition forces in these societies are very divided. Usually they are led by individuals, leaders banking on their personal charisma, but you do not have political parties with clear agendas, political opposition parties. And so Iraq has not proved a model, and in fact is demonstrating to democracy promoters that what you need in the region is a longer-term process that seeks to address some of the primary causes for why there is no democracy. And there are many of these. It's not just the fact that there is a dictator in power that needs to be deposed, and then automatically you will have democracy.
Let's talk a little bit more about what's happening in Lebanon now. You're from Lebanon, you grew up there, you know the country well. From what you've been seeing and reading and hearing from friends and family, are there a lot of parts of Lebanon that have been destroyed by the bombing that were only recently rebuilt after the civil war?
Yes, primarily civilian infrastructure such as bridges and highways that were all rebuilt after the civil war, and I think the airport being hit was also very significant for Lebanon, because the airport was a symbol of Lebanon reconstructing. During the Civil War, Lebanon had a terrible airport, and everybody would always comment about it. I mean, it was depressing to just land into that airport in Beirut. And when the new airport was built, it was just a symbol for the Lebanese and for foreigners who were coming, that Lebanon was really on its way up, that Lebanon was ready to reconstruct and become, a functional state and attract tourism and have a functional economy. And so, yes, the when the airport was hit, the bridges, the highways, those are primarily the areas that were reconstructed after the war.
What impact do you think is it going to have on life in Lebanon in the near future?
Well, in the near future, Lebanon, it's a devastating economic shock for Lebanon, because Lebanon has no industry or agriculture. It basically survives on services, and the tourist season is very important for Lebanon. And so these attacks have shattered hopes for this tourist season, but I think also will affect Lebanon for years to come. Because it has taken this long for Lebanese to convince the outside world that Lebanon is a great place to visit, that it would be a good place for foreign investment, that banks should set up there, that consulting firms should set up there. And I think now, with this instability, these companies, these banks, and also tourists are just not going to want to come to Lebanon. So it will affect Lebanon in the long term economically. Also, I think psychologically, this is very devastating for Lebanon, because Lebanese citizens were really not expecting this to occur. Even though they have lived through a civil war, and despite the fact that there continue to be acts of violence across the border, I do not believe that any Lebanese citizen could have foreseen this occurring in Beirut. And so I think psychologically this is going to be very difficult. And here I'm painting the best case scenario for what could happen in Lebanon. The worst case scenario is that this conflict escalates, that there is pressure inside Lebanon to disarm Hezbollah forcefully, that militias will arm, that the current Lebanese government will disintegrate, that the Lebanese army will break up. I mean, it's a very bleak picture, but it's not one that is it is one that could occur, and so that would be the worst case scenario for Lebanon.
Well, Julia Shakir, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Julia Shakir is deputy editor of the Arab Reform Bulletin and an associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Our interview was recorded this morning.